This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big new report out this week says that thousands of American schools have found one way to try to raise reading and math scores: cut back on teaching everything else. President Bush's No Child Left Behind program punishes schools that don't hit their marks in reading and math testing. Now, in a remarkable display of perhaps unintended consequences, a national survey finds 71% of schools squeezing out the rest. Science, social studies, history, music, art, all pushed to the margins. In some schools, it's reading in the morning and math in the afternoon, period. Up next on Point, narrowing the curriculum of American education to reading, writing, and testing. We go first today to the front lines in the education battle. Joining me now from Cincinnati, Ohio, is Leslie Ann Smiley. She is a third grade teacher at the Douglas School in Cincinnati. She's been teaching for 6 years. Ms. Smiley, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you had testing very recently. Before that, when did you last teach science or social studies in your class?
Well, we tried to integrate it before the testing time, but in Cincinnati, for January and February, our focus was just on reading and math using a buckle-down curriculum. So we changed the normal curriculum that we'd been using and focused with buckle-down, which is teaching the test-taking strategies. And we did that every day.
So buckle down is what it's called. And as I understand it, that meant reading in the morning, math in the afternoon,
yes.
And day by day, that was it.
Well, and of course, we tried to integrate social studies and science into that time, but there were really limited opportunities to do that. So the more authentic teaching of science and social studies occurred in the beginning of the year and is taking place now that testing is over.
Now, reading and math are pretty important in an education. Lots of people would see them as the foundation.
Certainly.
But what is it like for you in your classroom, to teach, on the other hand, reading all morning and math all afternoon? What's it like for the students?
In the problem in the January-February time of teaching reading and math exclusively was that the type of curriculum was more of a paper-pencil type, and it wasn't concept building. There wasn't depth to it. And that makes the students become bored. And it's like pulling teeth, and you become to feel like a entertainer trying to just keep them on task and getting them to learn. But it really affects their love of school, I feel.
Ms. Smiley, describe your school for us and your class. What kind of a student population? What kind of a community there?
It's an urban district, an urban area. Our school is a neighborhood school with a high percentage. I would say over 80% on free or reduced lunch, and we are a primarily African-American school. And the students, our focus since we're in school improvement is to meet our AYP goals.
Now, there's some lingo here. You're in school improvement. That's a status under No Child Left Behind. You're not in the red zone, crisis zone, but what? You're under the gun to get your school's scores up.
Correct. Well, No Child Left Behind with us, when you're in school improvement, after you've been there for so many years, the consequences are severe. They begin with the state can take over. You can be changed into a charter school. There could be any major change in governance of the school, including replacing all of the staff or most of the staff. So those consequences are very severe to teachers.
I understand you've only got 12 students in your class in third grade there at the Douglas School, so you are really focused on them with reading and math over these recent months. Is it working? Do you see them reading better, being better at mathematics?
I do. I do see that they've increased their skills in reading and math, but they'd also been increasing their skills in reading and math in the fall when we were doing it.
So how do you see it on balance? What's gained and what's lost with this tight focus on the tested subjects?
Well, the primary thing that's lost is the time for Cincinnati Public Schools in January and February, our time spent on buckle down since it was so focused on reading and math,
mm-hmm.
and we just tried to fit social studies and science in where we could, that the students weren't getting a foundation in social studies or science during that time. So now we're trying to make up for any time we lost, because as an educator knows, you can't just miss out on any form of science or social studies learning because it has costly effects in the future. And they'll be taking these tests on social studies and science in upper grade levels. Just because third grade is focused on reading and math doesn't mean that the science and social studies won't affect our state report card in upper grade levels in the future.
And beyond their performance in those subjects in the future, what about for these young people as citizens of the country? Hopefully their reading and ciphering is improved. But is there a cost to not having the wider education that you can already see in third grade or anticipate?
Well, the cost is that, I should step back for a moment. In third grade, we're lucky enough to use a reading program that has social studies with a large focus of social studies in it.
Well, that's good.
So they're learning about reading. For example, we were just learning about the Lewis and Clark Expedition. So
great.
They are getting history from that standpoint. But the science concepts, if you're not building them at a primary level, then you can't in sixth grade and 10th grade just begin.
And on the social studies side, you're building reading and math. Are you building citizens with this education?
I have to say, in the January and February time when you're just trying to fit social studies and science in, then we're not building it then, no, because the focus is just reading and math. So it's a matter of just trying to grab what you can and teach as much as you can of the science and social studies before the winter break and then after the testing time.
And one more question for you. You've been teaching for 6 years. You're a young teacher. I'm sure you want your students to have good reading and math skills, but what is it like when you're in the buckle-down mode, it's all reading and math, the experience of teaching? Is it demoralizing or does it excite you to see them getting those skills? How does it play out?
No, it's boring, and it takes away from your own enthusiasm of why you went into teaching in the first place, because you're not going to see the spark in their eyes. You're not going to see, you're not able to play with their curiosity and get them intrigued in a new concept, because you can't have any creativity in your lesson planning, especially when you're just doing the buckle down. You're just focused on those books and that test-taking strategies. And my concern is, in some districts, that it's going to deter teachers from being in the teaching profession or new teachers coming into the profession.
Buckling down. Ms. Smiley, we're very grateful to you for what you do there, and we wish you the best with it. We wish the best to your students as well on all fronts, reading, math, and beyond, and we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for spending a little time with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Leslie Ann Smiley, she's a third grade teacher at the Douglas School. She joined us from Cincinnati, Ohio. We're talking this hour about the narrowing of the curriculum in many American schools to meet the requirements in reading and math of No Child Left Behind. You can see, by the way, the report out this week from the Center on Education Policy at our website, onpointradio.org. Joining me now from New York is Thomas Sobel, professor of outstanding educational practice at Columbia Teachers College. He was New York State Education Commissioner from 1987 to 1995. Professor Sobel, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
You've seen the results of this survey. First of all, let's just look at the interpretation. I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that subjects other than reading and math are getting squeezed by the focus on reading and math testing?
No doubt whatsoever, not in all jurisdictions, but in a great many and all across the country.
Is it typically in the kind of school district that Leslie Ann Smiley teaches in? That's low-income, urban, largely minority, and struggling a little bit to keep its standards up. Is that where the pinch comes?
I think that is where the pinch comes. Let me say first that it was refreshing to me to hear Leslie Ann's voice expressing her opinion so clearly.
Absolutely.
One of the sadnesses, again, of No Child Left Behind and the way in which it has been devised and implemented is that the voice of teachers and other school personnel have effectively been excluded. We have policy people, we have government people, we have business people all churning the pot and brewing the stew that they want us to consume, but the voice of teachers has been absent. And if you want thinking, feeling people in your classroom, by the way, you've got to give them some room to think and feel. So it was good to hear Leslie Ann.
Wonderful to hear. And we hear the enthusiasm there. But what about this fundamental issue? I mean, we need American school children who can read and do math. If they're having trouble getting a hold of those basics, is it worth pushing the other things to the side? Do they have to be pushed to the side?
No, I don't think so. Tom, I'm reminded of something some Russell said. Maybe it was Bertrand Russell or Jane Russell, Lillian Russell, if you go back. Some Russell said that all social revolutions go too far. And I think something like that is what has happened with No Child Left Behind. Of course we want our children to learn to read well. Of course we want them to do well in mathematics. And of course you have to devote sufficient time to those subjects to see that they do learn. But what has happened because of the testing and the accountability measures that are linked to it is there's such a concern on the part of school people not to be found wanting,
mm-hmm.
Not to be embarrassed publicly by the outcome of these test results, that they've gone too far in one direction.
Thomas Sobel, what about it? You said all revolutions, and you're looking at No Child Left Behind as a revolution, contain the seeds of their own heresy. What do you mean?
We've just gone too far in a good direction. What we're teaching is what is being tested, and we're defining the subject according to the nature of the test. What we're doing in many places is driving out the rest of the curriculum and focusing on teaching students how to take tests in math and reading.
You say we've gone too far, but let me ask you. I mean, the needle is, as far as I can tell, and it's hard to figure out, but it seems that the needle on reading and math scores has barely budged. There's some controversy over whether there's been improvement or not. So if the scores have barely improved, how can we have gone too far?
We've gone too far in our expectations and the demands we're willing to impose upon teachers and kids. But we haven't gone far enough in the constructive direction of providing the training and support that are needed.
Mm-hmm.
When we're asking teachers in the schools to do something that nobody has ever really done, to bring all of our students to a high level of proficiency in basic subjects. And it's not clear to me that we can do that, but it's very clear to me that if we are able to do it, it's going to be because we've trained people to bring the best out of kids along the lines that we have in mind. And we haven't done that. We have not funded the act and provided the capacity building training that is necessary to bring about the goals that we have so laudably professed.
So just sort of laid down the law, you're saying, but not brought in the depth and breadth of support to make it happen in the right way, in a good way. Let's get another perspective here from Washington. Michael Petrilli joins us. He's Vice President for National Programs and Policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, was a senior Bush administration official in the Department of Education who helped implement the No Child Left Behind program. He's author of No Child Left Behind, A Primer. Michael Petrilli, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
First of all, do you see the narrowing in the curriculum that's described in the big study out this week? Is it evident to you?
It is. I think the study makes it clear that it's happening, and it's a big problem. I don't think it's what Congress intended. I don't think any of us want an education for our kids that's nothing but stripped down reading and math skills. We wouldn't want it for our own kids, and it shouldn't be good enough for anybody's kids. That said, I don't think it's fair to pin all of the blame on No Child Left Behind. You know, narrowing the curriculum, it's not the only choice that schools face. There are a couple other obvious solutions, and we'd like to see schools, really taking charge of those options as well.
What do you mean? No Child Left Behind laid down the requirement, and there's tough penalties if schools don't meet it, so why is it not a direct outgrowth?
That's right. Well, you know, again, certainly No Child Left Behind is having this impact, and Congress can fix it. Although the fix is not necessarily popular, and the fix would actually require more testing. It would say, well, let's also test in history. We're going to have testing in science start next year. Let's make those tests count also so that schools don't have this incentive to narrow the curriculum.
So that would be
but at the school level, you know, what Leslie Ann mentioned, there was one obvious solution. She mentioned that they, in her school, in her classroom, they were teaching the Lewis and Clark Trail as part of their reading instruction.
Mm-hmm.
You can teach these subjects, history and science and the arts, and teach reading at the same time. In fact, you have to teach them at the same time. Once students learn how to read, they learn how to decode, hopefully when they're in first or second grade, to sound out a word. Then what you need to do in order to improve their reading comprehension is to build their vocabulary. There's a brand new book out just this month by E.D. Hirsch called The Knowledge Deficit. And what Hirsch argues is that schools are really shooting themselves in the foot by just practicing these basic skills, doing the test prep, instead of having their students be exposed to great history, literature, science, the arts. These are the sorts of exposure that's going to help students to be able to prepare to really read, so that when a student picks up a newspaper, you know, they're able to sound out the words. But if they don't know the background knowledge of what the words mean, they're not going to be able to understand it.
So study that on the way to the test. And you say they can or they could, but we don't want to pretend today that the results are in. And the fact seems to be that post No Child Left Behind, they're not. Michael Petrilli, Thomas Sobel, stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Mo is calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Mo, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy the show, and I do agree with your guest. My wife is an elementary school teacher, and I just wanted to say that I think that the time that's spent on the MCAS here in Massachusetts anyway, because it's something that's relatively
school testing,
new here,
yep. Mm-hmm.
That all of the preparation that they're putting into that, I think that the creativity that the teacher has been really stifled, and that the teachers are really getting just upset with the whole thing because they feel that their hands are tied.
But what about the kids? Are they ending up with a better grasp of reading and math?
Well, as I don't know, I think as you said, I don't think the numbers are showing that the increase is all that much to be, you know, reckoned with as far as, you know, the, you know, what you're, I don't know, what you're substituting for. I don't know. I think that, like you said, I just don't know if it's worth it.
But in the classroom, what's your wife tell you? Are the kids having a good time with reading and math focus?
No, well, I think it's more that the teachers don't have the time to do everything that they need or everything that they would like to do with the time that's allotted. I think, and it comes down to, you know, basically what's allowed. And I think that their hands are tied at this point.
Mo, thanks very much for calling in. Let's get another call here, if I may. I want to turn to Clinton, Massachusetts, and Elaine. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you see, Elaine?
I see is that the truth is that our schools are not performing, and the current grading systems that they're using are leaving a lot of our talented youth behind. My son actually was helped by the testing because he was a kid who was underperforming, getting bad grades. And when they tested him, they found he was in the 94th percentile for perceptual reasoning and superior in language expression. And yet he's failing in the school systems. These tests actually made it so that my son was recognized as an intelligent kid, and I was able to advocate better for him to get him what he needs.
But in his school, your school, was it necessary to cut back on other subjects, on science and social studies and music and art to do that?
It is. In that part, you know, I'm with you guys on all of that they need to do it in a different way. We're educating our kids like we did factory kids. You know, we got this new stuff out there, but they're using the old systems to try and get through with it, and it's just not working. And kids like Christian are being left behind because of the old stereotypes that are built into that old antiquated educational system.
So there's a vote for some kind of push, but do it right. Thomas Sobel, what about the idea that we don't need to sacrifice anything here, that Michael Petrilli says, look, incorporate history, social studies, culture into the teaching of reading and math. You can do it all at once.
I agree absolutely with Mr. Petrilli on the matter. I wish more of that were happening, unfortunately.
Why isn't it?
I think that teachers need help in figuring out how to integrate these. Some teachers need help in figuring out from other teachers how to integrate these various aspects of the curriculum. The premise of No Child Left Behind seems to be that if you set the standards high enough and test rigorously and report the results to people, that people will be motivated to do better and teaching will improve and learning will improve and so on. And I don't think that's how school people get motivated very much. I know very few teachers who don't want their students to learn to the utmost capacity and to enjoy their learning experience. And what we need, it is not that they know how to do that already and just for some perverse reason have decided not to. It's because all of us, teachers, school administrators, policymakers, and so on, need to learn more about how to motivate and teach kids who are not doing well by way of our traditional system right now. Mm-hmm. And we need to apply that new learning on the part of all of us to working with them. And until then, you can raise that bar as high as you want. Kids aren't going to jump over it. They've got to want to jump, and they've got to be helped to learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Michael Petrilli, I don't want to reduce all of this to budget numbers, but there is a sense that people respond to in No Child Left Behind, kind of a philosophy that if you just whip the horse hard enough, you're going to win the race, but you've got to, you know, feed and care for the creature as well. President Bush said in his State of the Union address, big commitment here to math and science instruction, but the Department of Education's budget, discretionary budget, cut in the current fiscal year, cut last year. Have the resources been skimped on as the requirements that have been raised?
You know, there's a lot of money going into our education system. We spend about $500 billion a year in K-12 education. It's true that only a small percentage of that comes from the federal government. But the resources have been there for a long time, and we've dramatically increased spending in education over the last 20 years, and we didn't see the results that we wanted. But now, with the advent of accountability, and now with No Child Left Behind, we're starting to see some progress. You know, in Massachusetts, which has been at this for the longest, has been at it for over a decade, with high standards and a lot of support for teachers, we are seeing significant gains, especially for our poor and minority kids. You know, we can't get away from the fact that what No Child Left Behind is trying to do is close the achievement gap. We have a situation today where the average African-American 12th grader is graduating with the reading and math skills of the average white 8th grader. So we have a 4-year gap in those basic skills, and we could wish that that didn't matter, but it does matter. It matters in terms of opportunities for higher ed, for work, for all kinds of life outcomes. So we've got to close that gap.
But just cracking the whip doesn't seem to be doing it. I mean, right now we're seeing that the needle really isn't moving that much yet on performance, and we're seeing all these other subjects that keep students engaged and enthusiastic and molded as full citizens falling off the desktop, if I read this report correctly.
Well, let me offer you another suggestion, is to examine what's happening in some of the great public schools around the country, like the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power program. These are charter schools. There's about 50 of them now. And what they do is they're able to teach reading and math, extra doses if necessary, take kids who are many, many years behind when they come in the fifth grade. And once they graduate in eighth grade, they are performing, you know, at the top of grade level. They're ready to go to some of the best high schools in the country.
So what's going on in there that's not going on elsewhere, in your view?
Well, they are open from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. and on Saturday mornings, and they squeeze in a month during the summer. They have a simple philosophy. It says no excuses. We're just going to work harder and longer than everybody else is, and they get results. And the question for me is, why haven't schools responded to these new requirements by saying, look, if we need to do more, teach more reading and math, and we don't want to give up the rest of the core curriculum, why don't we talk about extending the school day? We still have places where we have a 5-hour school day. Obviously, we can't cram everything in, but why do we still have that system?
So if other subjects are being pushed to the margins, just study more hours, study longer, longer during the day, on the weekends and during the summer. Is that a roundabout way, Michael Petrilli, of taking a whack at teachers and teachers' unions here? Is the country prepared to step up pay to have them in there all summer and on weekends?
Right. I think people would be willing to pay that, you know, and I think that when you compare what's going on in our urban environment, where we tend to have a lot of kids who have been left behind, you know, those kids are not getting the resources that other kids are getting in the suburbs. They're getting a 5-hour school day while kids in the suburbs are getting a 7-hour school day. They're not getting homework assigned to them while other kids are. I mean, it's those kinds of issues that we have to address. And yes, the teacher union issue is there below the surface. Certainly, it would cost more to have a longer school day, but we have to ask, why are we paying all this money and only getting a 5-hour school day to begin with?
Thomas Sobel, what about it? More hours, wherever they may lie, during the day, the weekends, the summer, that's where you can have your art and music and history and all the rest.
I am very much in favor, of course, of productive longer hours. The question is whether you can improve things by spending more time on stuff that doesn't work. Again, the people in the KIPP schools, of whom I think very highly as well, know what to do in their situation that will motivate kids and produce the learning results that they want, whether it's a shorter period of time or a longer period of time. But that is not the case all about. We know that the turnover of teachers is much greater where kids tend to be poor than in more affluent communities, school districts. We know that the level of training and education and sophistication about teaching and learning tends to be directed to flourishing suburbs and not to troubled inner city venues. We need more time, but we need more time doing stuff that works, not more time at what our teacher called paper and pencil kind of approaches to checklist kind of approaches to the teaching of reading. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff doesn't work. And if you give it more time, it doesn't work twice as long.
Right. You can't just bang the desk more. Paper and desk. I want to get a call from Waterloo, Iowa, if I may. Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Great program. I definitely can agree with some of what the speakers are saying, partly because of experience, partly because of simple observation and being a parent of a 7-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
She's had early exposure to both art and music since she was very small and excels at reading, probably in the 4th grade reading level for a 7-year-old, and that's great.
Is she getting that in school, Carol?
Well, I think it depends. I think it, in part, comes from our own background. I'm an artist seeking an education on a non-traditional basis so that I can teach it privately, because the students that come through our home, where my fiancé teaches music privately, they see the art, they see the music, and they see a possibility of getting these things. And neither one of us is getting rich doing this, because a lot of these students simply, you know, they're not going to get it in school, but their families can't afford to pay it either.
But that's in your home, not in the public schools. So you're right. Enriching kids off the clock.
Right. Oh, more than off the clock. I mean, he teaches from home seven days a week.
But can we expect the public schools to do that for us, Carol? Well, or does everybody have to find, you know, you and your fiancé?
I don't know. And as we speak, I mean, what he's doing is they're bringing in other people. I mean, she's at a constructivism type school right now, and as we speak, he's there working with kids with no income at all to do it, but he's helping them out. They know there's a need, but, you know, what do they do?
Well, there it is. There's the joy in the whole range of learning that students can do and that teachers can teach. Right now, Ed's calling from Olmstedville, New York. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My concern is the lack of imagination that's shown both by the people who write the tests and the people who teach. You can't teach reading without some kind of subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
The subject matter should be history and the social arts and those things. You can't teach math without some context. Music is mathematical. You need to know whether you want a pound or a gallon of milk. You use mathematics and you use reading in everything that you do. It seems to me that rather than fuss about some federally instituted program, we should be looking for the good in it and take it as an opportunity to go for more imagination and better thinking on the part of the educational establishment, both that part of it
mm-hmm.
that writes the test
mm-hmm.
and the part that teaches for them.
But, Ed, if that's not happening, if teachers and educators look out there and say the richness is gone, then what are you suspecting? What's happening? How could it be drained of all that content?
I think they're taking the richness out, because if they're spending all their time on the ABCs instead of good literature, if they're spending all their time on the multiplication tables instead of applying the mathematics mm-hmm. to everyday life, then they're doing a disservice to the kids.
It can't just be Dick and Jane and flashcards. We hear that, Ed. Let me, to respond, turn to a voice from Charlottesville, Virginia. Andrew Rotherham is with us. He's co-director of Education Sector. It's a national education policy think tank. He's a member of the Virginia State Board of Education, a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute, served at the White House as education advisor to President Clinton, 1999-2000. He's author of the blog eduwonk.com, but we trust he's not completely a wonk. Andrew Rotherham, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What do you hear in this conversation? What do you see in this problem? How do we fix this? Is this an inevitable outcome of No Child Left Behind?
I think it's not, and I think it's been a very interesting conversation. You've heard a couple of views, and I actually think the last caller really showed that there's a middle ground here, and unfortunately, the debate to date is often a false choice between content, greater rigor, more ambitious standards, and more of the same, when in fact, as your caller just said, to really teach reading effectively, you need to be teaching kids content as well, and you can have a content-rich curriculum that doesn't exclude things like arts, history, social studies, and so forth, but does teach kids the basics. I think one thing that gets overlooked here is these tests that we're talking about, for the most part, and I'm generalizing here, every state has its own test,
yep.
as Mike Petrelli pointed out, but
mm-hmm.
for the most part, The what these tests ask of kids are things that parents, skills that parents would want kids to be able to have. These are not these are not overly ambitious tests, and in fact, in addition to sort of the content on the test, often the cut scores that are required for a student to be proficient are relatively low. In a lot of states, to pass the test, a student has to get half or a little more than half of the questions right. So these are reasonable standards, and I think rather than being outraged that things are being cut out of the curriculum, mm-hmm. to the extent they are, parents should be concerned about why are we unable to get kids over these bars, and in fact go much farther beyond that. I think that the problem with the test is not that they're too ambitious. In fact, if they're not ambitious enough in what I think most parents want to see their kids getting out of their
school. We hear that and understand it, but help us buckle that into what we've heard today. We started out with a teacher, Leslie Ann Smiley, in Cincinnati. She's been in the middle of a buckle-down curriculum there, nothing but reading and math. Reading in the morning, math in the afternoon. I mean, that's her reality. She's saying she's afraid what she's shortchanging students on. Is it possible that No Child Left Behind, that the whip being cracked here somehow, Andrew, has teachers in such a swivet, such a sweat, there's only so many hours in a day, that they're just reduced to a kind of a, panting toward the very narrow confines of the test, as modest as it may be in your view?
Well, I think you've hit on the key issue here, which is time, and it plays out in two ways. First of all, the number of hours in the day, and we need to have a discussion on, are we spending enough time? Can you do everything within the school day, as we conceive the school day now, that you want schools to be able to do? But then second, and as important, how we use time. One of the things that concerns me about this is there's very little attention being paid in many schools to how they teach. It's only being paid to how long they teach. And if you're not doing a good job teaching reading for 90 minutes a day or teaching math for 90 minutes a day, it's not axiomatic, it's not guaranteed that you're going to get better results if you start teaching it for 4 hours a day or for 5 hours a day. How you teach is more important than how long you teach. And very few schools are really aggressively using the data from these tests to really examine teaching strategies, really think through what they're doing, where are their weaknesses, where are their things that aren't aligned with the curriculum, and use that data to inform their decision-making and change their practice. And I think something that Mr. Sobel said is extremely important. Mm. The government has a role to play here, and I think No Child Left Behind has gotten sort of the urgency that we have to do a much better job than we're doing right now, particularly with low-income and minority kids who lag far behind other students in school. But it's not just enough for the government to demand that schools do more and the teachers do more. It needs to have a helping hand out there to help teachers. And that's more than just sort of the back and forth about money. It's helping them use this data, use this information, supporting really high-quality professional development, and helping people use time differently than they
Amen.
Do now by teaching more effective. And I think that's been a real weak link in the implementation of No Child Left Behind so
Michael
far.
Petrilli, how about it? Thomas Sobel points it out. He says this is the heart of it, and Andrew Rotherham is saying amen, and I hear you saying it as well there, but is this someplace where we need to refine the approach? Is it too much all stick and not enough carrot, not enough nurturing from the federal government with this program? Do we need some refining? How do you actually encourage that subtle, better teaching in a classroom instead of just waving the whip?
Right. Well, first of all, I think we should start by examining how our teachers are getting trained today. This content-rich focus is something that has been going on for now a decade in core knowledge schools.
What are you talking about there exactly, the content-rich focus, please?
Okay, that, Andy and Thomas, all of us are talking about how teachers need to teach content, not just these narrow reading and math skills. And there are some wonderful approaches available for schools to adopt. One is called core knowledge. The KIPP model is others. There's lots of good ideas out there about how to do this well. And yet we don't see schools embracing these ideas. And why is that? And I think we need to go back to the root. How are teachers getting trained when they're going through college? What ideas are they being exposed to? If you look, for example, at our schools of education, what you find is that the professors there, more or less, say, look, content isn't really all that important. What matters is that kids learn how to learn and learn to love learning. Well, if that's the message that we're telling our future teachers, then it's not surprising that once they get into the classroom and they're facing the pressure from these tests, they don't stand up for content. They don't even know where to turn, where the resources are. There are only a couple hundred of these so-called core knowledge schools around the country that are using this very content-rich curriculum. There should be thousands, 10,000. It's something that works.
But your language is suggesting that learning how to learn is content-free, and that clearly is not axiomatic. I mean, if you learn how to learn, the universe is at your disposal, right? This is the political debate that's sort of cloaked here in education language. You want the old-fashioned primer in there.
What I want is for teachers to be trained how to teach content. You know, but unfortunately, in many of our ed schools, it is content-free. They get these platitudes that say, well, you know, we want to learn how to learn, and that's fine, but let's actually teach a history teacher how to teach history. And unfortunately, that's not happening in a lot of our training
institutions. How to teach history or what to teach in history? Elise is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Elise, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi. I see a curriculum and a school in a town where we pay very high taxes. Mm-hmm. And expect very good education for our children. I see a curriculum that has become dull, a school that feels like it has lost all vibrancy. I have a fourth grade student who has come home crying because all they do is reading and math and prepare for the tests. I have three children in the public schools. One of them is in second grade, so she's not affected by the test, but we have something called the MCAS in Massachusetts.
Right.
And they have been losing sleep. These are children who are not at any risk in these tests.
And you're hardly in the inner city there, and you're hardly disadvantaged. And are you still seeing, in your circumstance, No Child Left Behind really pushing that or something else?
That is all they push. That is all they push. My children are losing sleep. They're crying. They're counting the days to the MCAS exam. They have done my fourth grade student has done maybe one day of science and one day of social studies this year. And it's infuriating. I am so glad to hear this program because I have been ranting and raving about it all year. And, you know, it's enough to make you want to pull your kids out of public school and send them to private school. But if all of us did that, then what would the public school be? But it is infuriating. They don't need to learn about the world. They don't need to learn about their surroundings because they have to practice how to write for a test.
Yeah, yeah, we hear it, Elise, loud and clear. And let me bring it to the panel here. Andrew Rotherham, here's a community, no shortage of resources. And yet, here's a mother. You can hear her description of her kids being sort of bored silly by a flattened education. So what's going on here? They shouldn't be so intimidated by No Child Left Behind. Is there some, you know, sort of meta effect here that everyone becomes hypnotized by the demands of the test and of testing and loses the bigger picture?
Well, I think the call is an important call, and it raises a couple of issues. First of all, it shows the extent to which sort of No Child Left Behind has become flypaper that everyone is throwing everything at, and it's sticking. The MCAS and the issue she talks about in Massachusetts preceded No Child Left Behind and are actually not
right.
Not
it's a Massachusetts
related.
Program, yes.
Exactly. And so, but sort of No Child Left Behind, and it's both because it's sort of, you know, taken up a lot of attention in education. It's also, frankly, because as polarized as the country is politically, it's associated with the Bush administration. It's taken on a real political tinge, the debate about it as well. So it's very important to sort of disentangle things that were happening separate from No Child Left Behind. Second, the issue she raised about the curriculum, parents whose kids are coming home where the anxiety of teachers and so forth is being translated to kids, they're coming home sick, that's outrageous. And to the extent that's going on, parents should be less concerned about the standards than why are schools creating an environment like that within their school. And it doesn't have to be that way. Just by one example in Massachusetts, Ted Sizer, who is a long-time proponent of sort of less standardized, more rich and engaging schools for kids. Not a big fan of standardized tests. He and his wife helped found a school called the Francis Parker School. It's located in Devon, I believe, right near Harvard, Massachusetts, a couple hours outside of Boston. It's a school that obviously does not teach the test. That would cut against the grain of the Sizer's philosophy. It's a school that's active in the coalition.
But fine to look at one school, but we're looking at the whole country.
Just a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
That school is doing terrific on the MCAS, but they're not teaching to it. They're not doing the things. And that's just one example, by way of example. The schools can do both, and it's not an either-or.
Good for them in their cozy corner, but the national picture is not so pretty here. We're trying to figure out what to do about it. Paul's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I hear, you know, and I hear all these educated folks talking about the schools and the testing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What about a parent's responsibility at home? I know your call screener said, you know, they're paying for, you know, the teaching to be done, but still the parents have a responsibility to make sure their kids are learning, to you know, reinforce what they learn at school, help them with their homework.
Paul, I completely agree, but let me ask you, I agree, parents have a huge, and families a huge responsibility, but do they have the time and resources when their kids are in school, when they're not homeschooling, to then give them all the social studies and history and science and music and art that they need outside of school hours, Paul?
Well, no, there's no way they could do that, but still, you know, helping children with their homework. If you want a No Child Left Behind, the parents need to be involved, and there won't be any children left behind. If they're good parents and they're trying to do what they're supposed to, then no child will be left behind.
We hear it. Absolutely. And yet, at the same time, we want to structure these big expenditures that we make as a community, as a society, to help those kids also who don't necessarily get that at home as much as we can. Robert's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
We're
great
good.
Show. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm a former teacher assistant, special ed here in Providence, and I'd like to bring up a couple of quick points. You know, it's I definitely agree with previous callers about stale curriculum. You know, you definitely have a problem when you're trying to teach Shakespeare, Elizabethan English, and they don't have a grasp of modern English. Why don't these curricula include periodicals and newspapers? And also, you know, if you really want to drive home a good, solid reading structure, why not link the periods together? Why not put English and history together in a larger period so that you have a whole wealth of things to choose from?
Yep.
And science can definitely benefit from being linked with math, because I don't think the students, and I know from my personal experience of also working in regular ed in the inclusion environment, that they don't see the relevance of what they're learning.
So don't just box it up. Let it all flow in here. Our time is short. Thomas Sobel, pick this up for us. Everyone's pointing to this, saying just because you have to teach reading and math doesn't mean that it should be drained of rich content. Pour that rich content even into the reading and math, history, science, literature, and we can have it all. Why not?
We should have it all, and it's heartening to have people urging us to have it all. Again, I think we need to give teachers a great deal more support in order to learn how to do it all. But, you know, as I've been listening in the latter part of our discussion today, it seems to me that too many people, not the people who've called in today or whom you have invited to talk as part of this panel, but many other people across the country have bought into a definition of education which is much more restricted, much more narrow than what we have traditionally espoused. Of course we want kids to learn to read, and of course we want them to learn to how to do mathematics and to use it well and appropriately, and so we want all those things. But traditionally, we've also wanted to turn out students who are prepared for a constructive life as a citizen of a democracy, who can hold a job, who can support a family, who develop their own personal talents and abilities to the utmost. All these larger goals of education are not just pure rhetoric. They are the life and life's breath of what goes on among teachers and kids every day, every year. And we will paradoxically, and I'll end with this, paradoxically, don't believe me, just remember, if we see more of this happening, we will see better results in reading and math by enlarging our scope and our sense of purpose, and by being guided by these other ideas that we have espoused throughout our country over time.
Well said. So much has been espoused and aspired to, and we don't want to drop it. Thomas Sobel at Columbia Teachers College, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew Rotherham at the Education Sector, thank you for being with us, Andrew.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michael Petrilli, Vice President at Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Mr. Petrilli, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.